Session number 17772.
Roy Hamlin, Reel 5. You were just telling me about some of them would have had to you open fire.
Yeah, the obvious thing then, when the illegal immigrants were brought in, were that the military police then took over full charge, and we were released from our obligations. We had done our job. We had interrupted the illegal immigrant boat, brought them in, and that was our task finished. So, strictly speaking, we had no other contact than that. The military police then took over completely. Their responsibility was taking care of, one can only call them prisoners in one sense, can't they? Because that's what they were. And as I say, they were put behind the barbed wire compounds. And it must have almost seemed as though they were back where they came from.
So you were waiting for these boats to come ashore, were you?
Well, interrupt them. Yeah, but they would be trying to land at some obscure place and then make their way. Possibly they would have contacts. The three terrorist gangs would ensure that perhaps contacts. I don't know whether they were in touch radio. I doubt it very much. But nevertheless, it was a very close network. People would have known, and possibly there were sites, unknown sites to us, that they could land quietly somewhere obscure, and then they would be taken wherever, possibly near to Jordan or perhaps somewhere like that, you know, where they would be out of the way. But we did suffer, obviously, casualties, because being transport, you were very vulnerable. I certainly felt very vulnerable on a motorbike, but you had a job to do. But I do remember one particular incident. Photography was never allowed from terrorist activity, but once or twice the rules were bent. And I remember once Mount Scopus. It was a convoy of six of our lorries were taking some kind of goods to Nablus, and they would go by way of Mount Scopus on the left-hand side of the Mount of Olives, and the mines had been laid in the road and the ambush was waiting. And I have actually got photographs of my vehicles being blown over to the side. And my officer was there, Mr. Metcalf. I can see him, he's on the photograph. These were illegal, by the way. They shouldn't have been taken, see. And I remember we were on the main headquarters of the unit was still then at Tel Aviv. And we had been ordered as B platoon, just the one platoon, to Jerusalem on the Bethlehem Road, actually, to do the transporting for that area, partly with the governor, because we used to go to Governor House and do part of the transport for the governor. But anyway, these vehicles were due to go to Nablus, and my officer was there, the major. We were standing looking at it, and he said a remarkable thing to me then. He said, you know, Sergeant, he said, how many times have we known through our army life of the person being in the right place at the right time, seen by the right person, medal? He said, but I'm looking at this, how many times have we known the person to be in what I would call the wrong place at the wrong time and seen by no one? And I thought, what a remarkable thing to say. But I got the gist of what he was trying to get at. That so often this has happened. We found that actually in Normandy. Sometimes you come across a body that, by the very expression on the face, it would tell you that it was a pretty horrifying situation that that boy had found himself in. There's no one there. Never know. There's just no story to tell.
But you were ambushed, were you?
Yeah, this is in Palestine.
Can you describe the ambush? What happened?
Well, the landmines have been laid so that the vehicles went over them and exploded. And then the terrorists are waiting with their guns. I mean, when you talk about a terrorist, it's just an Arab. I mean, if you come across him, it's just an Arab with all his gear on, and although they were Jews, but they were dressed as Arabs, and this is how they got through it, you see. This happened regularly.
But you were in this one particular ambush, were you?
Well, I sent the convoy out. There was a corporal in charge of that particular six. There was just six vehicles, just one section. It was his section that they were taking these particular goods to Nablus.
So you weren't there yourself?
No. No, it was brought back to me that my vehicles had been ambushed and would I go to that area. Yeah. I think one of the worst aspects when you come to this, I had a good little driver. He was called Kaminsky. He was English, despite the name, but Kaminsky. And driver Kaminsky was ambushed because the Jewish terrorist gang needed his vehicle to get into a unit and obtain goods or what they wanted. They were very clever at this. Documents could be forged, and they were very extremely clever. And driver Kaminsky was kidnapped because of the use of his vehicle. So he was imprisoned, kept captive, and the vehicle was used. And then he was very fortunate, he was released, but with a very stern warning that if he repeated anything of what had happened, he would be marked. Well, of course he had to report it. I mean, the detail that he had been sent on had not been done. So when he come back to report to me, he had to report what had happened. So then a most terrifying experience was experienced, not just for him, but for me as well, because the British intelligence came on the scene. And to me and the driver Kaminsky, they were worse than any three terrorist gangs could ever be with their questioning. Were we implicated in any way? And it was not a very nice experience at all.
You mean you were grilled?
Grilled very extensively. And in fact, driver Kaminsky's nerve was so broken, not entirely by the fact of being kidnapped by the gang, but by the interrogation. And we had to ship him off down to Egypt and transfer him down to an Egyptian unit. And of course, plus the fact that he could have been a marked man by the terrorist gang.
Was he in a nervous state?
Very. His nerve was completely broken.
Was violence used against you
no.
both?
No. No.
So
as I say,
why was it so unpleasant?
Because of the intelligence, because of the interrogation from our own people.
But were they just asking you questions?
Yeah. Very aggressive to him. Trying to establish whether he was part of the makeup, which is ridiculous, because of course he wasn't.
But what's the difference? I'm just asking you questions now. What's the difference between me asking you questions and the intelligence?
The method of their interrogation. The method. It was very, very intense. You were a criminal. You were guilty. We think that you done this. We think you done that. We think that you were part, which is the most ridiculous thing in the world, because of course we weren't. We were in our own unit. We had nothing to do. We had no contact with outside. But that was it. Yeah.
But were there shining lights into your eyes?
Oh, no, nothing like that. It was the vocal interrogation. Of course, then you did get your lighter moments. When my officer was demobbed, away he went, and Major rang up. Major Arc was very blunt. He was a very blunt officer. And we were on detachment, you see, as I said, people are doing it at Jerusalem. And the phone would ring, I'd pick it up, say, good morning, you know. And he would say, Horrocks here. He wouldn't say Major. Horrocks here. Is that you, Hamlin? No, Sergeant. Right? And then he would say, I want that bloody fool Bannister. And Mr. Bannister was my officer, second lieutenant, straight out of OCTU, straight out of officer training college. The first command that he'd ever had was part of B platoon, second lieutenant. And I was supposed to nursemaid him, say, where's that bloody fool Bannister? I said, well, Mr. Bannister, I've sent him to do so-and-so. Get him here. So poor old Mr. Bannister had to come, and he had to go through the rig of something other that he had failed to do. He did finally get rid of Mr. Bannister for me, and I did feel so sorry for him, because we had a important convoy that went down to Beersheba, and we had to go through Gaza, near the Gaza Strip, and there I found Mr. Bannister, and he'd been demoted to what we called a WOG platoon, which was the Arab dregs that were working for the British Army to do manual work. And there was Mr. Bannister in charge of these people. I felt very, very sorry, because I liked Mr. Bannister. He was all right. I mean, he made stupid mistakes, but he was only a second lieutenant, just out of OCTU. And in fact, I had two more arrived, Mr. Metcalf and his friend. And you see, this boyishness. Now, we worked in a stone little square building with a corrugated iron roof. And there we did our office work with the unit in Alamein Barracks, this is in Jerusalem. And I had a clerk, he's a very nervous disposition, very nervous indeed, Mr. Barker, Private Barker, and we were getting on with our work, and my two boy officers, because that's all I can call them, boy officers, decided to have a little bit of a lark. They'd have turned me out of my bed the night before. They'd come back after being on the drink. They came in, they thought they'd have a bit of fun. I was in on the tent, you know, in my bag, and they tipped it right over. So that was their first bit of fun. But this next day, they decided to have a further bit of fun. And so they gathered together a large amount of rocks, threw them up in the air, and it came down on the corrugated iron roof. Just remembering that at any given time, a Jewish car would come along with an homemade bomb, and it'd be thrown into the unit, and bang, you were getting this all the time. And this is what they decided to do. They took these rocks up and threw them up, and down they come on the corrugated iron roof. And my little fellow, I think he actually did dirt himself. Anyway, he shot out through that door, and it really, he had to see the doctor. It really did. He was a very nervous disposition, see. But anyway, these lads, they simmered down. I'm afraid I had to say a few hard things, because you couldn't have it, could you not? It would have undermined the discipline, wouldn't it? I mean, two things right off like that. If the lads had known, I was tipped right out of bed. Anyway, I told the, because I was attached then to 470 Ambulance Company for messing purposes. And I did mention it to the powers that be down there. I was very friendly to begin with the MSM, that's the Mechanical Sergeant Major, and with the Sergeant Major himself. They said, Roy, no good. He said, you mustn't deteriorate discipline. He said, you'll move your bedding. We're giving you a berth down here with the 470 Sergeants. and you'll be messing in with the force MO. And of course, this is what happened, and they were told, you know, to simmer down. And because after all, you know, we were on detachment, you see, we were away from headquarters. That was the important thing. And you had to keep a stern look on the discipline of the unit. I was very fortunate that I got on the 51st Island Division, funny enough, also had a unit in that camp. And if those lads misbehaved themselves, belonging to the 51st Island Division, part of their punishment was to follow the bagpipes around the cookhouse for an hour. Didn't make them very popular with the bagpiper, because he had done nothing wrong, but he had to go playing his pipes around the cookhouse for an hour. And with the Jankers boys having to follow up. But I was able anyway to, if any of my boys did misbehave themselves, they could either take a choice. Do you want to go down and see the major, or do you you accept your punishment along with the 51st Island? And most of them opted for that. And so they had to. So I was fortunate there that the 51st Island Division did the discipline for me, as well as doing it myself.
What date would that ambush have been when you sent out those six vehicles on the road? Said it was the road to Nablus.
What date?
Yeah.
Oh.
Which year would it have been?
1946.
And they were on the road to Nablus?
Nablus.
From Jerusalem?
From Alamein Barracks. From Jerusalem. Yeah.
And what year would it have been when Kaminska's lorry was?
1946.
Same year?
Yeah. Yeah.
Which years were you in Palestine then?
1945, we arrived there. The whole of 1946 and 1947 until I was demobbed, the summer of 1947.
Were you in any ambushes or shooting yourself?
No. No.
Were you worried about any of that happening?
Not really. I mean, whatever happened would happen, and you just got on with the work that you had. I suppose perhaps I should have felt vulnerable, because when I remember it now, one of the favourite photographs that my wife really likes, and I just had it enlarged by one of our comrades, showing me on the bike ready. I used to go from Jerusalem down to Tel Aviv, down to Sarafan, and I would be entirely on my own on the motorbike. I never thought about it. I honestly never thought about it. I had to go down to see the major to report and give whatever, and away I used to go.
You mentioned the two sergeants who were killed by the Zionists.
Yeah.
Did you have anything to do with that incident?
No. They were Air Force. No, we were. It was reported to us as we reached there. I did get to know the farmer very well, where the bodies were found. It had nothing to do with him, of course, but I was very friendly, because I would be sending out detail. We were working as a military unit, but working through the civilian as well, so that my vehicles were dispatched out to all these different designations. And I got very friendly with a lot of the farmers. In fact, one of them did allow me to help him with the planting of small orange trees, you know, in the grove. I often wonder whether they're still there. Would they be after 50 years? I don't know.
What did he tell you about finding the bodies? Did he find them?
I didn't find him, no.
No, did the farmer find the bodies?
Yes, he reported that.
What did he tell you about that?
I horrified. I mean, he had no inkling. I mean, it was completely without justification. They were hostages. They were simply hostages. And yet they killed them.
Was this farmer a Jew or an Arab?
Jew. Yeah. But they weren't all terrorists. I mean, we did a lot of work with them. In fact, I think I visited every kibbutz that were in existence at that time as a guest. You understand the kibbutz, of course. And I loved it in that atmosphere. You know, I could understand how they progressed in that atmosphere. I mean, some people might call it communism, but I certainly didn't call it that. There was nothing oppressive. They were simply there for each other. No, I find the life in the kibbutz very peaceful.
How had you got to know this Jewish farmer who owned the grove?
By the details that I was sending out of the vehicles. The work would be, that's all part of the structure. See, we worked through these farming outlets, as well as the industrial outlets, as well as the military outlets. The transport was there to use, and it worked very well, actually.
How did you feel about leaving Palestine in 47?
Perhaps I was brainwashed. You know, when I think of it now, I had the opportunity for further promotion. Had I gone with the unit, we were poised to go down to Suez. And perhaps with hindsight, I think that I made a mistake. But we were brainwashed. Everything was, when we get out of this ruddy army, when we get this ruddy uniform off, when we get back to Civi, and of course, it was accentuated by the fact that Ordi Mob was being put back and put back. I actually wrote to Michael Foot, who was the MP for Plymouth at that time, stating my objection. You know, why is it that this demob that I should have been out about 6 months previously was being put back and put back? And I'm afraid that we got rather brainwashed into wanting to return to our civilian life. But with hindsight, I think I would have been much better had I, say, 3 years or whatever, and gone down to Suez, and I think I would have been quite happy. But I didn't. Of course, in that case, I wouldn't have met Mrs. Hamlin, would I?
Now, after the war, you joined the Normandy Veterans Association in Newton Abbot.
Yes.
But you told me that the chap who was responsible for setting it up lived in a bit of a fantasy world.
Yeah,
can you repeat the story that you told me?
Yes.
Well, we won't mention his name.
No,
but just tell me about what happened.
Well, when I first met this lad, I was very impressed with him. He was very enthusiastic. He welcomed you. Although the only contact I had with him was by phone, when he said about joining the or forming the Normandy Veterans Association here in Newton Abbot, and when I arrived at the British Legion, he actually knew me. He said, "You're Roy, aren't you?" He stuck a label on me which said Roy, so that whoever we met, we could say, "Well, you're Dick, you're Harry, you're Fred," and we knew who we were talking to. And I was most impressed. He gave us quite a story that we were going to have Lord Delfont as our patron, that he was going to supply us with £1,000, and we were going to get the HMS Hermes as a floating hotel off the coast of Arromanche during the 40th D-Day anniversary. And it seemed that everything that he had planned, that we were going to have a really good time, everything paid for, we got patrons would see to that, and we went along with the story completely. He had everybody enthralled by it. And it wasn't until a little bit later we had a extraordinary meeting called at the British Legion, and we all arrived wondering what the story that we were going to be told. And it was the man's brother had arrived from Somerset to tell us that his brother was a fraud, that nothing that he said was true, that he had never been to Normandy. And such was the following that the man had at this meeting that, well, quite a third, mostly I would say perhaps of the Cornish connection, got up and walked out and followed the chairman out. But where that left us then was, quite frankly, that we had to...
Because they sympathised with the gentleman who'd started it.
He started it, because such was his influence on them. He was a very convincing man. And
what unit did he say he was in Normandy?
That I don't know. I'd forgotten.
In the army?
Yeah, the army. But I'd forgotten that. I think it was the commandos. Because such was the convincing manner that he had that he even went to Limpstone, which was the commando depot, told the powers that be on the gate. He said, "I'm so-and-so, representing Normandy Veterans Association. We would like to visit you." And he was invited in. And even given a meal. The party that he had were even given a meal in the sergeant's mess. And they were each given the green beret. And that's how convincing he was. And anyway, when he had left, or he went down to the main bar of the British Legion, and we were left looking at each other, wondering what on earth to do, and we realised that we had to be very quick to, if we wanted the NVA to start in this area, we had to form a committee and get on with life. So the whole other thing had to be disbanded. We had to accept that what the brother had said was right, and we had to start from scratch. So a chairman was appointed, the secretary was already there, the chairman accepted the job of treasurer for the time being, the dual office, and then he looked around for the officers to form a committee. He gradually got names together. He looked at me, he said, "Roy," he said, "you're very keen on this, will you come into the committee?" I said, "Well, yes, all right." So I came on the committee. And then when we met for the first time, we realised the state that we were in, that we were saddled with a couple of bills from the Flags and Banner, which amounted to a flag, which the ex-chairman, if I can call him that, had said would fly on the rear, on the stern rather, of the HMS Hermes, and the NVA flag, and a standard, which cost the best part of £800, and